before we move on, are there any more questions about Brightview? Yes.
It's sort of a living example of it while I was walking after lunch. I was just noticing how I was sucked up into the beauty of the trees and the sky, and there's all the garbage on the ground. And I usually try to pick a little up when I didn't have my bag, so I had a little guilt pushing me. Well, okay, I can't do anything about it. The garbage is here, and I can accept the garbage with the beauty. But I thought my overall desire is for a world without garbage. I hate the garbage. I really hate the garbage.
Okay.
Well, it's
you're
right.
Living in the wrong world, then.
But at least I'm in Bellingham.
Yeah, at least you're in Bellingham, where garbage is relatively under control. You're not living in Manila.
No. Correct. What is right view?
Right view right there says, okay, if there's something I do about it, I'm happy to help the situation. If there's nothing I can do about it, I've got to just let it be. You know, we're sharing this world with lots of other people who have lots of other agendas. And if you're going to go around straightening other people out, there's a story they tell in Thailand. This hungry ghost lived up in the rafters of the hall in one of the monasteries. And there's a belief that that's kind of where hungry ghosts like to hang out, because when people make merit, they dedicate the merit to the hungry ghost, and it's a convenient place to be, right there with the merits being made. So they like to hang out. And so there was a group of people came, they were coming for a gitin, which is a big kind of group donation. They spent the night before the gitin in the meditation hall, sleeping. And the hungry ghost was looking down at them, and their heads were not in line. So I went down and pulled everybody so their heads were in line. Then I got back up and looked down from the rafters, and their feet were not in line. So I went down and pulled everybody's feet while everybody was in line. And then I got, their heads are out of line. All night long. So are you going to be a hungry ghost?
Let's hope not.
Let's hope not. So the whole point of right view is that you would be responsible for where you are in terms of your actions and what you're doing. And you take care of what you can. You'll notice that all the forms of right view, they are views. In other words, they're not knowledge yet. They're a view that you take on as a working hypothesis for the purpose of action. We're not here to attain right view and then stop, or to affirm right view and say, okay, that's a way thing. It's a guide to help us to figure, okay, what needs to be done. And they keep pointing in, okay, what are you doing right now? When you're, especially what's happening in your mind. Take care of that. And if you have any extra energy, okay, you clean up the garbage. But then you realize, okay, you don't want to be a hungry ghost. Mm-hmm. Take care of what you can, and then make sure that your first priority is in here. And then you help the world out of that as you can. So do I love right view? Any part of us that says, no, I can't agree? Okay, let's move on to right resolve then. This follows immediately right view. Let's see what passages. Thank you, Rihanna.
Page six.
Okay. Resolve for renunciation, resolve for non-ill will, and resolve for harmlessness. Okay, resolve for renunciation is specifically renouncing sensuality. Sometimes you hear this defined as renouncing your controlling mindset, or renouncing unhealthy relationships. Well, for the controlling mindset, you don't need the Buddha, you can go to a psychologist. If you're unhealthy relationships, you don't need the Buddha. You can go to your parents and they'll tell you about unhealthy relationships. The Buddha's talking about renouncing your desire or keep on thinking about sensual pleasures all the time. That's what the renunciation means here. Because you realize if you don't learn how to let go of this stuff, it's going to be very difficult to let go of the craving that's causing suffering. This is one of the first ways you do it. Resolve for non-ill will is basically resolve for goodwill. Resolve for harmlessness is resolve for compassion. Remember, we talked yesterday about a little bit about goodwill and compassion. This is where that practice, the practice of the Brahma Viharas, fits into the Noble Eightfold Path. It's there under right resolve. Make up your mind, this is going to be the basis for my action. Sometimes you hear about practice of metta or the Brahma Viharas as a complete practice. It's not complete, it's only one part of the Eightfold Path. It's on the resolve path part. Also, right resolve has two levels. What's listed here is actually mundane right resolve. There's another level of right resolve, which is essentially to get the mind into concentration. To get into the first jhana requires the resolve. It grows out of your desire to get past sensuality and ill will. When you're in the first jhana, you're not going to be involved in sensual thoughts. You're not going to be thinking anything about harming anybody else or having ill will for anyone else. So that's how right resolve develops itself. The Buddha himself talked about the ways in which mundane right resolve grows into what he calls transcendental right resolve. There are two different passages. One is when he realized, okay, if my mind is going to find peace, I've got to go for a renunciation. And he said, my mind did not leap up at the idea. It's not the first thing to say, hey, I want to resolve and renounce sensuality. It's only when he reflected on the fact that if I don't, I could do a lot of damage. I could cause a lot of harm. So I should learn how to renounce that. Then he got into the first jhana. And from the first jhana, he said, well, this still is not refined enough. I should refine it even more. But again, his mind did not leap up at the prospect of not thinking at all. It wasn't until he realized the drawbacks of thinking that he said, okay, let's drop the direct thought and evaluation, going to the second jhana, and so on down the line. In other words, it's looking at the results of your actions and realizing, if I don't let go of this, there's going to be trouble. And then using that as motivation for letting go. That's one way he depicted his own process. The other place is where he was talking about how he actually got onto the path when he started looking at his thoughts, not just in terms of what their content was, but in terms of where they came from, where they led. And some thoughts come from sensuality, ill will, harmfulness. And then he said, if I realize, if I keep thinking these things, those are going to form, he didn't say the word ruts, but basically that will incline the mind in that direction, to act in that direction. Like, every time you think those things, it creates another rut in your mind, and it gets easier and easier and easier to get into the rut. And so anytime a thought of that kind came up, he said it was in the same way that a cow herd would treat the cows during the rice growing season. Now this is a big issue in Asia, or was, you know, until recently. If you had cows, you had to be very careful you didn't get into anybody else's rice fields. They talk about colonial administrators in Sri Lanka. And that was their job, basically, was to adjudicate fights between cow owners and rice field owners. Because the cows would wander in and eat the rice, crush the rice plants. So your job as a cow herd during that time of the year is to check and beat and basically keep those cows out of the rice. So when something unskillful comes up, you do what you can to curb it, to keep it under control. Then he said, then he noticed that his thinking result, you know, based on renunciation, non-ill will, or harmlessness would arise. So that kind of thinking is okay. He said, I'd let that go in the same way that after the rice has been harvested, the cows can pretty much wander anywhere they want. And as a cow herd, you have to have an idea of where are those cows going right now and not worry too much about them. But even then, he said, he realized if you thought nice thoughts like this for all day and all night, you'd get tired. You might be much better off going into concentration. So with that thought, that was when he brought the mind into concentration. That's how growing from mundane right resolve moves into transcendental right resolve. Do you have any questions on right resolve? After lunch for questions. So it's the worst time of the day for teaching. Okay, from right resolve, the desire you don't want to harm anybody, comes right speech. Abstaining from lying, abstaining from divisive speech, from abusive speech, and from idle chatter. Here's where we start getting into the area of the precepts. Although, for the precept dealing with speech, there's only one. This is the precept against lying. Because there are times, this you'd see this one when looking at the rules that the Buddha has about speech for monks. There are times, divisive speech literally means basically, you see two people are coming together and you try to divide them. Either for fear that if they come together, they'll gang up against you, or that you're jealous of them somewhere. But there are times when you know that person A is going to abuse person B if they get together, so you've got to warn person B. And you have to do this skillfully, because sometimes the more you warn person B about person A, the more person B wants to meet person A. You have to learn how to do that skillfully. But if your intention there is to prevent one of them from harming the other, then it's okay to speak in ways that would kind of warn the one who might get harmed. Similarly with abusive speech, there are times they say that speaking harshly to somebody, if they don't listen to your nice words, sometimes you have to speak harshly. The Buddha himself, one time called Devadatta a lickspittle. It's one of those. Those terms of insult we don't use much anymore. You know what it means, lickspittle? Someone spits something on the ground, you lick it up. At any rate, the Jains found out about this, and so they got this prince. He said, hey, prince, do you want to become famous? You can beat the Buddha in an argument. Here's the question you ask. Would the Buddha ever say anything unpleasant? And if the Buddha would say no, then he said, well, they have him on record for calling Devadatta a lickspittle. If he said yes, then you can say, what's the difference between you and everybody else? So the prince goes to see the Buddha. And it's kind of late in the day, and he realizes it's too late in the day to have a cool argument in front of a lot of people. So he invites the Buddha to his house. It's because of this story, this is sometimes why we warn the monks. When you go to somebody's house, watch out. It's not always for the best intentions that they're inviting you. So he feeds the Buddha meal, and then after the meal he comes up and he sits down with his baby son in his lap and asks the question. And the Buddha says, well, that's not the kind of question that you can give a straight categorical answer to. And this prince realizes, okay, the Jains have been defeated. And so he tells the Buddha what his intention was, and the Buddha gives his example. He says, so, you know, that baby son you have on your lap. And the commentary says that the prince bought the baby son just in case if the argument was turning against the prince, he could pinch the baby son. The baby son would cry, and that would be the end of the argument. And so the Buddha says, this baby son you have on your lap, suppose he got something sharp in his mouth, what would you do? He says, well, I'd have to take his head in one hand, and with my other hand, I'd put my finger in his mouth and get the sharp object out, even if it meant drawing blood. Why? Because I could think of the harm that would come if he swallowed it. The Buddha said, in the same way, there are times when the Buddha says it's, you know, the kinds of speech that the Buddha would say is, one, is it true? Okay, he would at least speak it only if it was true, but then if it was true, then I had to pass another test, is it beneficial? If it's beneficial, then it has to pass another test. Is this the right time and place to speak in a pleasing way, or is this the right time and place to speak in an unpleasing way? And so sometimes you have to be harsh. And there are a couple of examples, and several more examples in the canon, where the Buddha is quite harsh with people. But you have to look at your intention. Okay, is this going to be beneficial? If not for that person, at least for the people around. So there are times when abusive speech is actually skillful, but you have to be careful about your motivation and also about your own ability to read the situation. And finally, idle chatter. You try to abstain from it, but there are times when, I guess what I call it, social grease. You need to have a little social grease in order to keep the office running and keep the family running well. You just talk about things that get everybody in a good mood. But even then, idle chatter, technically speaking, means speaking something with no clear intention in mind at all. Just opening your mouth and seeing what comes out. That kind of chatter, that's idle chatter. Now you want to abstain from these things. Abstaining from lying, and the Buddha took that very seriously. In fact, there's one point where he says, this is the main precept. If anyone lies without a sense of shame, or deliberately lies without a sense of shame, he says they can do all kinds of evil. So that's the first precept in terms of importance. And it's one of the reasons why right speech is listed before right action. You look in the Jataka tales. These are tales that were collected. Most of them seem to have been collected after the time of the Buddha. And many of them are known to have existed in other traditions as well. It's just kind of the Buddhist link made to them. And part of the motivation behind that, I think, is trying to say, well, if you're going to become a Buddhist, you don't have to leave behind all the rest of your traditions. It's kind of like saying, come to America. How do we make Americans feel okay about being Buddhist? Well, say, Paul Bunyan was the Buddha in a previous lifetime. Johnny Appleseed was the Buddha in a previous lifetime. That kind of thing. So they were collecting all kinds of stories and attributing the Buddha's previous lifetimes. And in these stories, there are times when the character who's supposed to be the Buddha will kill, will steal, will have illicit sex, will drink. Never lies. There's a number of cases where the Bodhisattva lies. So it's meant to be very important. As the Buddha taught his own son, Prabhupada, the first thing you need to know is when you practice is you're not going to tell a deliberate lie, even in jest. In other words, the kind of jokes which are basically lies. So that means if you have an active sense of humor, you have to learn how to phrase things differently. And you don't exaggerate things, you don't. I mean, a lot of the wrong speech is things people engage in wrong speech, divisive speech, and kind of racist jokes, abusive speech, there's abusive jokes, idle chatter, just purely silly jokes. You want to avoid that kind of humor and then cultivate the humor where you're actually telling the truth. And this is why people like Will Rogers and Mark Twain were considered great humorists, because they weren't lying and they weren't exaggerating, they're basically telling the truth. They're famous lines. One of my favorite Mark Twain lines is, consider the fly. An example of intelligent design. Pure intelligence, no compassion. Then goes through this long list of the horrible things that flies do. All the misery that comes into the world because of flies. He said, if a human being had designed this, he would not want to have his name associated with it. And yet we're supposed to sing God's glory every week. So that's right speech. Any questions?
Right. You know, white lie.
It's still lying. Okay, well, you have to figure out some way to talk about the topic without lying and without giving the full story.
Not giving the full story be a liable mission, though?
We don't have lies of omission. Again, you have to really look at your intention. If your intention is to deceive the other person, okay, then it would be a problem. But if your intention is not to give information that's going to hurt them or hurt somebody else, because there is one passage where the Buddha says, if by telling the truth you give rise to more greed, aversion, and delusion in yourself or in the person you're listening to, you don't want to do it. I mean, the one that people always come up with, someone comes up to you and they're wearing an ugly dress and she says, how does this dress look on me? Or how do I look in this dress? You've got to be quick, you know.
What's the answer?
The answer is always, you look fine in that dress. And then, of course, the word fine here is a comparative term, right? You look better in that dress than you would look if you weren't wearing a dress at all. There's an example that gets everybody upset when they tell it, but in Thailand, people like that. There was a monk living out in the forest. And being a monk living in the forest, you have to be on good terms with everybody. That means even with the criminals and other people who tend to live in the forest as well. So one time he was sitting and meditating under a tree and he saw this thief who lived in the forest running past with obviously something that was valuable and it was not his. And so he figured, whoops. So he gets up from where he's sitting, goes and he stands under another tree. And pretty soon the police come along. They say, "Did you see this thief?" And the monk said, "Standing here, I haven't seen anybody." So, that's one of the stories that divides the sheep from the goats. I know some people get really upset by that. You have to make up, when you're making a precept, or you're taking on a precept, you're saying, okay, I make up a promise to myself, I'm not going to lie. That means you have to exercise your discernment, you exercise your ingenuity. So that you don't have to tell a lie and say, you know, at the same time, you're not going to hurt somebody's feelings or hurt somebody's well-being.
So you're saying it always comes back to intention.
Comes back to intention. But it also comes down to what comes out of my mouth will be true. There's nothing false going to come out.
Tricky.
It's tricky. But this is one of the reasons you take on a precept like that, is it exercises your discernment. You know, you take on, we're going to write action in it about no killing, okay? What are you going to do with ants? What are you going to do with other pests in the house? You've got to figure that out, and you've got to be prepared. Question?
The monk the thief didn't intend to do harm, perhaps, but he did hope that the police would understand his answer to me, "No, I haven't seen the thief." Right?
Well, if the police was listening very carefully, police might say, "Okay, thank you, and go on." There's always the question that comes up, you know, you've got Jews hiding in your attic and the Nazis are at your door. What do? We don't wait for the Nazis to come to your door, you know. You go down to the Nazi party, you buy beers for the Nazis. You get on friendly terms with the Nazis. They're not going to come to your door. That's how you protect them. Because do you think that they, you know, say if you lie, they're going to believe you? When they're expecting everybody, the answer to their own, of course, no, I don't have anybody up there. That's not going to drive them away. So you have to figure out, okay, if I've got Jews in my attic, I've got to be prepared. Be more clever about keeping them in the attic safely. Right action. Okay, all of these are precepts. Abstaining from taking life, abstaining from stealing, and abstaining from sexual misconduct. Sexual misconduct is defined as adultery or sex with minors. And these precepts, when you take them on, really are meant to be absolute and across the board. As the Buddha said, once you take them on, and you actually follow them in all situations. So you're giving a gift of universal safety to everybody. And as a result, you'll have a safe share in that universal safety. So even though they're not divine commandments, they are meant to be taken on seriously and followed consistently. Not just when you feel like it, or not just when it's convenient. Because once you raise the bar in this way, then you've got to figure out, okay, how do I deal with pests in the house? And what is it? You know, as a monk, we've learned when you build something, you build it so that the pests won't come up. This is one of the reasons why they build houses on stilts in Thailand. Because you can put protection around the stilts so the ants don't come up and down. If you're building a house that's built on the ground, you can actually build a little, so it's like a little moat around the outside of the house, and you cover it up. You can fill it either with water or with oil, and the pests don't come in. Which means you've got to think ahead of time, because you know there are pests in the world, and so you've got to protect your house.
You do have, say, mice in your basement, and you don't want to put out snap traps for them and they don't go into your live traps, and you have a cat that you allow into the basement, knowing that cats eat mice. Is that...
As long as you don't give the cat the order to kill the mice. But they won't go into your live traps.
Mice are pretty clever.
Okay, well, I've found that it's usually because you haven't quite figured out what they really like.
Peanut butter.
They love peanut butter. And if your mice don't like peanut butter, we'll find something else. Is that, for me, that's the best way to deal with them as a live trap. And part of this is, I was talking with someone who'd been a hunter. You really meet any real hunters. I mean, people who actually would set traps and things like that. And he says, when you're hunting an animal, you have to get into that animal's mind. It requires, it's bizarre, you're going to kill the animal, but you have to empathize with it first.
Yeah.
You go, okay, where? What attracts them? What do they find fearful? And in doing this, you begin to, you develop a kind of empathy for forms of life that you might not have thought of before. And it's a good practice. So in the mouse's case, they don't go for cheese and they don't go for peanut butter. Okay, what do you think the mouse really wants? Try different things.